Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up over the next half hour, an insider's view behind the scenes at the Asian bishops' plenary meeting, which just wrapped up in the Philippines. And we take an exceptional peek inside the Pope's private chapel in the Papal Palace. Inside and out, that's where Asia's bishops say the Church needs to be looking to heal its failings and face the future for a better, fairer, and more peaceful world. At the weekend, Pope Benedict XVI's personal envoy, Cardinal Francis Arinze, formally closed the 9th Plenary Assembly of the Federation of Asian Bishops' Conferences, or FABC, in the Philippines capital of Manila. Vatican Radio's Father Joseph Chuang followed the meeting in Manila for us. He asked FABC Secretary General Archbishop Orlando Quevedo of Cotabato to explain the bishop's message to the churches of Asia issued at the end of the plenary.
How do we live the Eucharist in Asia? And that was the whole topic of the assembly. And the final document has two kinds of recommendations. One is inward looking, I would say ad intra. Pastoral recommendations, meaning to say how can the Catholic community understand the Eucharist in a better way so that they can live it in their lives. And the second is ad extra recommendations. And these recommendations look outside the church towards society, Asian society in particular, with its problem of peace, problems of violence, of ecological destruction, of sometimes the creeping relativism, and thirdly, the capitalist type of model of development, which in the process of globalization is not helping the poor countries as much as it should. The Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, has encouraged Asia, the Church in Asia, to do the precise thing, to share its gifts to the world. Be missionaries, he said. And it's not missionaries in the sense of converting people. It's a missionary in sharing what we say in Asia, sharing the story of Jesus to others. And the way we live community, that is also another contribution that we give.
The Asian bishops reviewed a recent regional survey on Asian youth and the Eucharist carried out among 1,200 young respondents in the region. They were questioned about their knowledge of the liturgy, why they receive communion, and about the effects of the Eucharist in their daily lives. The results from the data pointed to a need for more effective catechesis on the Eucharist for young people in Asia. Well, Archbishop Lawrence John Saldana of Lahore, Pakistan, spoke to Father Chung about the relationship between young people and the Eucharist in his church, particularly in the wake of recent anti-Christian violence in Pakistan.
Yes, our community is very fearful and very much concerned, and they are feeling very insecure because there have been two attacks, one at the end of June and one at the end of July. Now the people are at the moment very much dependent upon the help that we are giving them in order to face these problems. Lives have been lost and people are now very much concerned that this may be repeated in the future. The government has become very, very supportive, and the government has sent the police to guard them, and also the government has arranged for rebuilding the houses in Goja. And the work has already begun. And also there have been movements from the Muslims also to bring about peace and forgiveness and reconciliation. So this is also very, very positive.
The assembly of the FABC is on the deepening of the Eucharist. In what aspects do you think this can help the Catholics to keep their faith alive and promote peace?
In these days, more and more people, even the youths, are coming to the church and participating in the Holy Mass, because they feel that from this Eucharist they can get the necessary strength and grace in order to witness to Christ and to be His faithful servant. So therefore the Eucharist, I'm sure, has a very important role to play at this stage in our history, when we are at the moment feeling that we are being persecuted, that we are being oppressed. At this moment, we feel that the Lord, the risen Lord, gives us new courage, hope and strength.
It's one of the private chapels of the Popes, located in the Papal Palace, just down the hall from the Sistine Chapel. As the Pope's private chapel, it's normally off-limits to the public and even to Vatican personnel like me. But after restoration work on the Pauline Chapel finished in June, some of us had the perhaps once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go up and take a peek at it, and at Michelangelo's two huge frescoes adorning the walls. The sweep of the nave and the white stuccoed reliefs framing Michelangelo's massive, colorful paintings left me breathless. The chapel takes its name from Pope Paul III, who in 1537 commissioned Antonio da Sangallo the Younger to build it for his personal use and for holding conclaves. Pope Paul asked Michelangelo to decorate the central parts of the two long walls with frescoes. Michelangelo was putting his last touches to the Sistine Chapel when Paul told him to paint the first fresco, the Conversion of St. Paul, which he began in 1542. In an unusual juxtaposition of themes, the Italian master painted the second fresco, the Martyrdom of St. Peter, between 1546 and 1550. By then, Michelangelo was an old man who probably felt like he was being torn in wildly different directions. He was asked to design the grandiose plaza on Rome's Capitoline Hill, complete the Farnese Palace, and upon the death of the architect Sangallo, he was charged by Paul III with designing St. Peter's Basilica. In his book, The Lives of the Artists, his friend and biographer Giorgio Vasari wrote, "These two frescoes were Michelangelo's last." He told me, Vasari wrote, that it took him a great effort to finish them. Of the Sistine Chapel's Last Judgment, Vasari wrote that Michelangelo's masterpiece had rendered to the world
the great exemplar of the grand manner of painting, directly inspired by God, and enabling mankind to see the fateful results when an artist of sublime intellect infused with divine grace and knowledge appears on earth.
As he did in the Sistine Chapel, Michelangelo packs the Pauline Chapel frescoes with figures whose muscular bodies are revealed under tightly bound tunics and drapery, their forms so similar to the sculpted figures he loved to draw out from marble.
The best of artists hath no thought to show, which the rough stone in its superfluous shell doth not include, to break the marble spell, is all the hand that serves the brain can do.
Here, Michelangelo unveils sculpture-like figures in the Conversion of Paul, who falls from his horse to the ground, struck and blinded by a thunderbolt sent from Christ himself in heaven. The fresco is packed with people who, through their movements, create a sense of depth in a plain green and blue landscape. The city of Damascus, Paul's destination, off in the distance. Facing this fresco on the opposite side of the nave, St. Peter, who is fixed to a cross, about to be raised and crucified upside down. Unlike the lofty figures adorning the Sistine Chapel, so far out of our reach, Peter here is close, staring straight at us. Also here, the scene is packed with people, soldiers and onlookers, even a fellow finishing the digging beneath St. Peter so that the cross can be planted in the soil. I didn't go to the Pauline Chapel by myself. I had one of the best guides you can ask for, the chief art historian responsible for the restoration project, Professor Arnold Nesselrath from the Vatican Museums. I asked him, a bit naively, when the Pope uses the Pauline Chapel. After all, Pope John Paul II preferred to celebrate Mass and pray in the modern Redemptorist Mater Chapel, next to the Papal Apartments. Where is the Pauline Chapel in the palace anyway?
Where the Chapel of Redemptoris Mater is on the second floor, i.e. on the floor of the state rooms of the Holy Father, where he receives people in private audience. The Pauline Chapel is on the same level as the Sistine Chapel, and both are connected by the huge Sala Regia, the Royal Hall, or however you want to translate this, i.e. the hall where the Pope meets the, always met the most important visitors, that's why it's the Royal Hall, and where he even always receives, at the beginning of the year, the diplomatic corps to celebrate the beginning of the new year. The Pauline Chapel is the so-called minor palace chapel, while the Sistine Chapel is the major palace chapel. And the major palace chapel does not have a tabernacle, so the Holy Sacrament is kept in the Pauline Chapel. And therefore, the two also have to be connected somehow. You have to be able to get from the one to the other during a liturgical celebration. The Chapel of the Holy Sacrament is one function of the Pauline Chapel. The other for which it was built was that in the Pauline Chapel, in the minor chapel, up to the year 1670, the votes were cast during the conclave. And the newly elected pontifex was venerated on the altar of the Pauline Chapel. That function changed and moved to the Sistine Chapel only in 1670, when the Collegiate of Cardinals became so big that they did not fit into the Pauline Chapel anymore. But the two chapels are closely interlinked, and those were the two functions, and the Chapel of the Holy Sacrament is the function that the chapel still has to the present day.
And how many? You said that the whole College of Cardinals could not fit into the Pauline Chapel at one point. How many people can be accommodated in there?
When a Mass is celebrated in the Pauline Chapel, I think the capacity is up to 80 to 100 people that can sit on the benches that will be put up again in the chapel. But of course, during the conclave, the cardinals would sit along the walls, and that's also a reason why the dado of these walls is so high, so they could put in the stalls with the baldachin, and this function in some way conditioned also the architecture that Antonio da San Gallo the Younger had to design.
Many artists were involved in the decoration of the Pauline Chapel, but none so famous as Michelangelo was in his day. Lorenzo Sabatini painted the stoning of St. Stephen and the baptism of St. Paul in the chapel. Federico Zuccheri painted the fall of Simon Magus and the baptism of Cornelius the centurion. Magnificent stuccos and figures adorn the walls and vault. But Pope Paul was determined to have the best artist around for his centerpiece frescoes.
Paul III ordered Michelangelo to interrupt the work after the so-called Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel and to move to the newly built chapel, i.e. to leave in ruins the entrance wall of the Sistine Chapel.
What do you mean in ruins?
Well, the frescoes on the entrance wall fell off the wall in 1522 when the door lintel cracked and even killed two Swiss guards when Pope Hadrian VI was moving in for the Mass at Christmas. And they never could restore the walls. And when Michelangelo was commissioned to do this in 1532, they decided to change also the altar wall and then to go back to the entrance wall. But in 1534, Clement VII died, Paul III became Pope, since work had started on the altar wall, they had to finish that, but then Paul decided they would not go on in the Sistine Chapel, but Michelangelo had to move to the newly built Minor Palace Chapel.
And you intimated to me that he wasn't too happy with that decision.
Of course not, because he'd only finished half of what he meant was meant to do in the Sistine Chapel. So he felt constrained. He had to invent completely new scenes. He had to invent scenes he was not particularly used to invent. He was painting historical scenes, the conversion of St. Paul and the crossing of St. Peter's. Before, he'd mainly painted figures, sibyls, prophets, even the Last Judgment is a great vision. The only histories he'd painted were the stories of Noah on the Sistine ceiling. So after 40 years, he takes up a task in terms of iconography that he was not very used to. And then those were two scenes which require very few figures. Conversion of St. Paul requires a Paul and Christ, and then everything else is up to the invention of the artist. The crucifixion of St. Peter's basically requires Peter's on the cross and some assisting figure. So he had to fill these huge spaces with figures because that was the main thing he was inventing. And he arranged them in these incredible spaces, and he gave these scenes this incredible depth.
There are no real points of reference in Michelangelo's St. Paul fresco. Michelangelo creates the sense of depth by positioning figures in the foreground, in the middle ground, and beyond, inviting us to wander into the scene. And Michelangelo was no fast worker. It took him 8 years to complete these two frescoes, works that his competitors would have knocked off in just a matter of months. But again, no one was a multitasker like Michelangelo, so busy with his other jobs.
People like Botticelli in the Sistine Chapel, or Raphael in the Stanza, or Ghirlandaio, his master, still in the Sistine Chapel, or in Santa Maria Novella in Florence, they take about 3 months to do something like that. And the fact that it took Michelangelo 8 years also indicates that he worked on these frescoes alone, and there were no assistants to continue when he was busy with other things, and he accumulated quite a number of commissions, like becoming the architect of St. Peter's, while he was working on these frescoes.
And he was getting on in years, wasn't he?
Well, he was 67 when he started, he was 75 when he finished. He fell ill during the period when he painted these frescoes. People thought he would even die, so he was very frail. He was not a young man anymore.
Now, it can seem rather obvious why Paul III would have wanted to commission Michelangelo to do the crucifixion of St. Peter and the conversion of St. Paul in his own private chapel. However, there are lots of other stories connected with these two saints, two apostles, that he could have chosen. Why do you think he chose these two?
Well, it's not obvious to choose these two scenes, because what would have been normal to choose the conversion of St. Paul and the handing over of the keys to Peter. This is the pair that goes together. And in fact, Vasari, in his first edition of The Lives of the Artists, does even say so. So that maybe that was even the initial commission. The other pair, traditional pair, would be the crucifixion of St. Peter's and the martyrdom of St. Paul. So the fact that he basically crosses over these two pairs, I think, must have an iconographic meaning. It's sort of a kind of evolution shown across the princes of the apostles in these two frescoes. And that is something very unusual.
The St. Paul and St. Peter frescoes face each other on parallel walls, and we, the visitor, find ourselves stuck in between them. we too become part of the dialogue.
The only figure that has eye contact to the visitor is St. Peter. He's the only figure that's looking at the visitor, and he is the Pope, he is the Vicar of Christ on earth, and he's the one through whom the visitor enters these scenes. But there is this interrelationship between the two frescoes, which is not the traditional pairing, but it's the first step, which is the conversion, and it's the second step, which is the crucifixion.
Pope Paul III obviously made a very personal choice when he decided which scenes he wanted Michelangelo to depict. What message did Paul want to get across to the visitor through the conversion of Paul and the martyrdom of Peter? What does one think about standing in this chapel? For me, it seemed as if Michelangelo and Pope Paul were drawing a circle from the beginning of belief in Christ and the spreading of the good word through apostles like Paul to the end, the ultimate sacrifice, the willingness to give up one's life for that belief, and the knowledge that that belief will continue to the end of time.
I'm sure this is important in this. Now, we mustn't forget this is a chapel where the new pope is being elected. And during the election, the Collegium of Cardinals is accompanied by the two princes of the apostles, of whom one becomes the Vicar of Christ, not the other one. That's what's also then happening to the cardinals who choose one from their middle to become the new pope. And then it's a question of who sees, because Paul is blinded by conversion and Peter is seeing through martyrdom. So there is also a process here that goes across from one fresco to the other and then ends up with a visitor that's chosen by Peter to be looked at.
Exactly, because one thing that does hit you when you won't go into that chapel is Peter is staring directly at you.
Yeah, and this is an experience that each visitor has who comes into the chapel. Now, that's also, of course, an experience that every cardinal had who entered the chapel when they were going to elect a new pope. And I think this is something that's also very important for the understanding of the two frescoes in this context, and then those are the two who guarantee also the respect for the Holy Sacrament and who teach what the Holy Sacrament is.
Were you surprised by anything that the restorers found or came across when they were doing the restoration work?
What we found was a Michelangelo who suffered when he did these frescoes for the reasons we've already gone into. And we see the giornate, i.e. the various parts of in which the fresco was painted, in a very irregular, cut in a very irregular way. And this is something very unusual. We see the joints sometimes not cared for very much, not closed in a very proper way. We've noticed that Michelangelo was using different kinds of mortar over that long period, and that creates lots of technical problems, which he himself had sort of covered over by a lot of use of secco painting, a second way of painting over the fresco he'd done before.
So on a dry base, you're saying?
On a dry base. Mm-hmm. We can understand a lot about the artist in the process of doing this. Other things are that the little city of Damascus, which is, of course, an important piece in the iconography, Michelangelo probably never had contemplated of painting, and seems to have been forced by some advisor to add, because it's painted over the landscape, again painted in a dry way, why it had suffered, why it had been overpainted a lot. And when we took off the overpainting, we found underneath a very subtle, almost Pompeian, bluish city in the distance, with architectural forms which remind us of what Michelangelo, during these years or shortly afterwards, is inventing for the new St. Peter's. And then, of course, one should mention the enormous correction in the cross of St. Peter's. Michelangelo has used cartoons, like you do in frescoes. You draw the fresco in scale 1:1 to get the whole composition to the wall. And one part of this is even preserved to the present day in Naples. Now, after he transferred the cartoon for the cross of St. Peter's to the of St. Peter to the wall, he corrected this. He slightly turned the cross, and he turned the head to give it more emphasis. And these are things where you can see how he works to the very last moment on the composition.
But before I left, there was a surprise lying in store for me. Michelangelo, I learned, refused to nail his St. Peter to the cross.
You have this enormous figure of Peter lying on the cross, and Michelangelo had not painted the nails. They're not original. They have been added later on because of the criticism at the time that he put Peter on the cross without being fixed to it. There is a lot of interaction that's going on in the picture, and that's going on with the picture after Michelangelo had finished it.
What do you mean? He painted Peter without the nails in his hands?
He was just lying on the cross, and there were no visible nails. And Gigli, one of the art critics of the time, held this against him, this was iconographically not satisfying.
And so how did the nails get there in the end?
Well, someone painted them. I mean, they're there now. They have been there for ages. But the early copies of the fresco, the engravings by Beatrice, or the drawing attributed to Lelio Orsi at the British Museum in London, they show the figure of St. Peter without the nails.
So the polemics
at the time of Michelangelo, or after people became familiar with the fresco, seems to be something real and tell us something about what the fresco originally looked like.
It's hard to imagine that the body of Peter hanging onto that cross. He's so heavy looking and very muscular. It's hard to imagine him there without any means of support whatsoever.
Well, that's what some contemporaries thought, but there may, of course, be an iconographic interpretation, a theological interpretation behind that. That is something for which we have no documentation. And that's something that can probably still be researched.
Professor Arnold Nesselrath is the chief art historian from the Vatican Museums, responsible for overseeing the recent restoration of the Pauline Chapel. A very warm thanks to him. And that brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.